It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to a chef from Wisconsin about Hmong cuisine on this week's edition of Food Friday. He'll share some recipes and tell us how he shares his family's story through his cooking. First, Facebook is facing a lot of pressure this week. Last month, the Wall Street Journal published internal documents from the company shared with them by a whistleblower. This week, that whistleblower, a former Facebook employee, went public and testified before Congress. Francis Haugen, a former product manager for Facebook's civic misinformation team, accused the company of failing to stop misinformation, polarizing and violence-inciting content, and more. Haugen has filed at least 8 complaints with the Securities and Exchange Commission, alleging that Facebook has broken the law by lying to its shareholders about related issues. Ultimately, Haugen argued that Facebook prioritizes its bottom line above all else.
The company's leadership knows how to make Facebook and Instagram safer, but won't make the necessary changes because they have put their astronomical profits before people.
Facebook has dealt with Congress in the past, but this time might be different because Haugen is supporting her claims with research the company did itself on the way its products affect people and democracy. We're talking about what the Facebook whistleblower revealed to the public about the company she used to work for. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you one of the many Facebook and Instagram users? Does this information change how you feel about using these platforms? Have you decided to stop using either of them? Do you see lots of misinformation or a focus on inflammatory content that gets a lot of engagement? Pro and con. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Young Mi Kim is a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication and a faculty affiliate in the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison. She's an expert on social media and politics. Young Mi, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
You've been following these issues, some of the ones raised in these hearings, for a long time. First of all, what stood out to you, Young Mi, about what we heard from this whistleblower?
So, you know, there has been a lot of information leaked from like Facebook. So there have been a lot of like PR scandals. But this time it is different because her claims are based on the internal research evidence that no one else could do or are able to access. Even like academic researchers are not able to do such a detailed research because Facebook does not share the data. I mean, they have some academic partners, but they share like only part of the data. But this research she leaked seems to be based on very well-designed studies, and it specifically focused on the causal inferences, like what caused like what. Another thing is that I want to point out is that she also revealed the allegation that the Facebook relaxed its standards on misinformation after the 2020 election and dissembled the civic integrity team that worked on combated like, misinformation during the election. So that might have led to January 6th like, riots in at the Capitol. This is very different than what Mark Zuckerberg told us at the hearings earlier this year.
A big question when it comes to misinformation, and kind of inflammatory content. People sometimes criticize Facebook for not blocking some of that information. A lot of what came out in these hearings, though, isn't so much about blocking, but how much Facebook amplifies it, how algorithms reward, in some ways, inflammatory comments and misinformation that get a lot of engagement. Can you, and again, I know this is something you've been following. Can you share your thoughts on that, Young Mi?
Yes. Like, so what she argues is that Facebook keeps users coming back, but also systematically boosts the content that is polarizing, misinformative, and angry. So that this is like a systemic problem. So this is not just about like a content moderation, but about like an algorithm. Algorithm is kind of a recipe. You know, it prioritizes what content should be shown to the users first, and what content should be prioritized in traveling on the site. They came up with a so-called meaningful social interaction ranking algorithm system, which prioritizes posts that inspires social interactions and conversations between family. Facebook's assumption is that this meaningful social interaction ranking algorithm would gonna boost happiness. But in fact, the research, the whistleblower leaked, shows that it is quite the opposite. In other words, because people are reactive more to and reactive and responsive to more to the negative content, like angry content, fear and threats, those kind of things. As a result, this divisive content and angry content and misinformation got a higher rank and then prioritized on Facebook.
So I want to spell out how this might work in practice, Young Me. Somebody might post an inflammatory document, maybe it's misinformation, and I say, hey, I really agree with this. And then you say, I really disagree with this. And then we argue back and forth for a while. From the Facebook algorithm perspective, that's good stuff because it's getting a lot of engagement, right? And so it's going to show that to more people. Is that how it ends up working out in practice?
Right, exactly. So if you use Facebook, you see the like button, reaction buttons, oh, I hate this, I love this, emoticons, right? And then comment sections and, oh, I agree, I disagree. And then those kind of engagement got a higher scores, a higher weight as an ingredient of this algorithm. And then that's why it makes it will increase the user engagement, means that it generates more data and a more profit from Facebook's perspective. But it actually promotes the negative inflammatory content more than others.
We are talking about Facebook after whistleblower testimony. First, documents leaked to the Wall Street Journal, then a 60 Minutes appearance from the whistleblower, then a congressional committee with more appearances likely. Young Me Kim is with us, professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison, an expert in social media and politics, has done a lot of research on misinformation on social media. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As we've been talking about, these documents and this testimony suggests that Facebook's algorithms, the way they weight posts and who they should show them to, they've been shown to push divisive content, stuff that makes people angry and more likely to engage. Have you witnessed this firsthand? And then misinformation, what do you see Facebook's responsibility to slow down the flow of misinformation, to stop it entirely? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Young Me Kim, professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison, talking about the testimony from Francis Haugen, the Facebook whistleblower who appeared before Congress this week. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Young Me, you mentioned past testimony from Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook founder. Want to give a listen. This is back in 2019 in the fall, being asked about political ads. This is Mark Zuckerberg being questioned by Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
So you won't take down lies, or you will take down lies? I think it's just a pretty simple yes or no.
Congresswoman,
I'm not talking about spin. I'm talking about actual disinformation.
Yes, in most cases, in a democracy, okay. I believe that people should be able to see for themselves what politicians that they may or may not vote for
are
saying.
So you won't take them down.
Judge their character for themselves.
So that was about political campaigns and politicians themselves and misinformation. What do we know, Young Me, about when Facebook does and doesn't take down deliberate acts of misinformation?
Well, so Mark Zuckerberg also had hearings earlier this year, and consistently he argues that Facebook did its best effort to take down misinformation by hiring third-party fact checkers, but they don't take down like a politician's like a statement like that is consistent. But this time, what they have found is that the therefore, and then they you know, the Facebook like thinks that like there was like a no link between election fraud, like a Stop the Steal movement, and then on Facebook, for example, and then to like a Capitol riot happened on like a January 6th. Whistleblowers like claims are very different than like what Mark Zuckerberg said.
Let's bring out a caller now. Tom is with us in Rhinelander. Tom, hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. I am on Facebook, and I've looked in on some acquaintances who are involved in QAnon, and I've seen them report some really odd things, reporting that Trump won the election. They've reported and included links that say face masks cause cancer. And I've reported these things to Facebook, and the first few times I did, Facebook took action and labeled them as false. And then after that, nothing happened. They just would ignore my complaints. So I think Facebook has set up a mechanism to get rid of things that are dishonest, but they're ignoring it and not using it.
Interesting, Tom. Thanks for that call. Young Mi, have you seen things like that?
Well, in fact, I could, you know, my research team did some study during the 2020 election. So we tracked 1,500 volunteer participants' exposure to Facebook posts and other social media posts, focusing on Stop the Steal movement. So we see that whether we examine whether our participants are exposed to any posts that include election fraud, discourse. And then we found that 60% of our participants were exposed to at least one post about Stop the Steal on Facebook before and after the election. And it includes the content that organized the Jan. 6 Capitol riot. For example, the president of the United States has requested your attendance at the Capitol riot, and then a lot of posts that got incited such violence.
Thanks for that call, Tom. We'll go now to JJ in Madison. JJ, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, JJ?
Oh, so, you know, this whole thing is really interesting to me, and I'm in my early 20s, and, you know, I haven't been using Facebook for years because, you know, it seems like my age group demographic specifically doesn't use Facebook as much because we know it's garbage. But, you know, I have family that's especially older family that's susceptible to a lot of things they see on Facebook, especially, and, you know, both sides of the spectrum, left and right, you know, extremists. And I'd stop using Facebook because I'd otherwise just be arguing with family all day, every day about stuff that's obviously false, but they can't know. They don't know any better. They can't figure it out for themselves. And so I wanted to know what your guest's professional expert opinion was on what can really be done that doesn't, you know, violate free speech and is legal in current legislation for the SEC and, you know, anti-monopoly stuff and, you know, making sure that people are well-informed and not just lied to, or if that's just legislation that needs to be written and is going to be therefore just impossible to do.
JJ, thanks for the call. Young Mi, is there anything, any regulation that you think would help and allow JJ to get along online with his family again?
Yes. So that is a very good question. So far Facebook focused on the content moderations, like they identified a certain language and then just to try to remove the posts that include such language. But obviously that didn't work very well. So then as an alternative, they also try to identify the network of inauthentic behavior, like a fake account, but that didn't work either. Ironically, I find, you know, some solution is that actually we should find the solution from the algorithm itself. In fact, the whistleblower also emphasized that, for example, the meaningful social interaction ranking system that is based on an engagement, like our reactions to the post. But instead of doing that, why not using just the chronological ranking system? So we just see that the news feed in a time order, and the recipe does not include engagement. So that's one thing. Another thing we could do is like a transparency on the algorithm. I'm a strong advocate for like, increasing transparency, not just the content we are seeing, but also the like, algorithm itself. So you can think of it as sort of, if you buy like a food product and you see like a nutrient information, you know, social media like a Facebook might, you know, they are able to provide like a nutrition information like an algorithm ingredient. Then like we could see like you know what would be the problem and how we could fix it.
In just our last moment, Youngmi, are you optimistic that we'll see something like that either voluntarily from Facebook or required by law?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I could, you know, compared to other times in the past, I'm a little bit more optimistic just because it looks like a Congress in general are more educated about Facebook and then how algorithm works and then things like that. And also both parties like seem to be very upset this time, and then they agree on we need some kind of a regulatory solution. For example, like a Section 230 is a part of a U.S. law that allows like tech companies to moderate the content, their service, and also that means like you know the social media companies are not liable for illegal things. And then Section 230. Both parties like don't like Section 230 for some reasons. For example, like Trump doesn't like it because it could censor certain content. Biden doesn't like it because it gives Facebook is not liable for misinformation.
And we have to jump in there. That's all the time we have. Thanks to our guest Youngmi Kim, UW-Madison journalism and political science professor. Join us for a look at Facebook after the release of internal documents from the company. The school year is hitting its stride around the state, but after 2 years of disruptions from the pandemic, there's a lot of catching up to do. Madeline Fox went to Hackett Elementary School in Beloit to see what that looks like.
Hackett Elementary has students from pre-K to third grade, which means most of its students haven't actually had a normal pre-COVID school year before. Hackett was virtual in spring 2020 and for most of last year, transitioning into 2 in-person days a week for the last couple months.
Some of the kids didn't come back, unfortunately, so it would be 18 months since they've been in a school.
That's Ryan McReynolds, Hackett's principal.
Some of the younger kids haven't been in school ever. It'd be their first time stepping foot into school.
Especially in elementary school, a lot of what happens in the classroom can't be easily replicated online. Beyond academics, students are also learning how to share, how to resolve conflict, how to raise their hands and focus. In first grade teacher Sarah Honig's classroom, the first lesson after lunch is a review of the letters that they learned last year.
All right, we have 2 new letters today.
Yay.
You learned these in kindergarten, so we're going through them kind of fast. How did you know that?
There's always some review at the start of a new year, but Honig is really drilling down on some concepts this year.
Basically just prioritizing what they really need to learn, like content-wise, not covering the little things, trying to combine things to get the most bang for my buck with my teaching, the social skills, super important getting back into the swing of things. A lot of these kids missed their entire kindergarten year.
She also knows how squirrely kids can get, so she tries to change things up throughout the day.
We're back and forth from the carpet to the seats. They have an assigned spot on the carpet, so they're always sitting with the same, you know, in proximity, and we're pretty spread out as well. We keep the day moving. First grade's busy.
Third grader Ian Murillo says sitting still was one of the worst parts of remote learning last year.
Online, I just need to sit and sit and listen and listen.
In remote learning, there were a lot more challenges than just sitting still. Not everyone had a quiet place to work or regular internet access. Many kids had to share their space, which came with a lot of distractions.
My little brother always goes in in the bedroom and he just jumps behind and I tell him to not and to go somewhere else and do your Zoom, but he says, but I have no Zoom, it finished.
Remote learning went so differently for different students last year, depending on their resources as well as what and how they learn best. That means where they are right now is really different from student to student as well. Jacqueline DeGeorge teaches the English language classes for a bilingual immersion third grade class.
They had already gone to school, you know, a couple years. So as far as the routines of school, the third graders in my classroom have adjusted very well.
She says the first couple weeks were mostly gauging where kids were on their academics.
Already we've started doing the formative assessment to help us see where the students are reading at and what kinds of things we might need to work on in small group with them or individually with them. So not a test in the traditional sense, but built into assignments and day-to-day interaction with the students.
DeGeorge says she has been seeing some more gaps in what kids know this year than in a typical year. To Principal Ryan McReynolds, the important thing is keeping school in person.
Everything's gonna come with time. You know, kids are gonna get what they need. Biggest thing we need them is here. So as long as they're here, we'll take care of what we need to take care of. We just need to be here.
That's why masks are required, and he's got a big box of extras in his office to run down to students who lose them or get them dirty while they're eating or at recess.
Just in case. Awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome.
School districts around the state are doing that same dance. They're working to figure out where kids are and what they need to catch up academically and socially. But there's always that worry that they'll have to close again, even temporarily, and could lose some of that progress with students. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after news, it's Food Friday. A chef and Wisconsin native talks with us about Hmong cuisine and how he tells his own family's history through his cooking. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up Monday at 8 on The Morning Show, Native American food traditions are showing up in restaurants here in the Midwest. The chef shares ingredients, recipes, and stories. That's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now it's time for Food Friday, and this week we're listening back to a conversation from earlier this year about Hmong cuisine. Hmong food has a deep history with roots in Southeast Asia. It's been part of the American culinary landscape for more than 40 years. Our guest says it's more than just food, it's a way of connecting with his heritage and telling a story. You can find some of the recipes we'll be hearing about and recipes from all of our Food Friday conversations over at wpr.org/foodfriday. Yia Vang is a chef and owner of Union Hmong Kitchen in Minneapolis, St. Paul. He's also the season 3 host of Relish on Twin Cities PBS and co-host of the White on Rice podcast. He's originally from Wisconsin. I talked to him back in April.
Well, tell us some of the inspirations for your dishes. I understand they come from, in many cases, your own family.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, what I always tell people that Hmong food isn't a type of food. It's a philosophy of food. It's a way of thinking about food. And so a lot of times people just, you know, think Hmong food is, it's egg rolls and, you know, different noodle dishes. And I think, yeah, it is. But I think that there's a deeper meaning into the way that we do food and how we do food. Like I say to a lot of people, Hmong food, if you want to know our story, if you want to know our people, our cultural DNA is intricately woven into the foods that we eat. So if you want to know the story of our people, know our food. So yeah, and a lot of the dishes that we do, a lot of the dishes that we're inspired by comes from mom and dad's table. And they've always been, you know, that's kind of always how they've, you know, made sure that we were taken care of. Like everything could be falling apart, but there we know that there was always three meals a day at the house.
Can you talk about just that, the family and social meaning of the food that you grew up with?
Yeah. So, you know, when people who aren't familiar with the Hmong people, I kind of give them, you know, like a little brief history of the Hmong people, how they ended up here in the Midwest. You know, this is after the Vietnam War. Our people have become refugees after the war and ended up here. And so when you have a group of people like our people who don't have a land of their own, country of their own, or just, you know, a flag of our own, what we have is each other. And you have a family unit that's built within, and what's tight within that family unit is food. So, you know, like I've told people, my dad didn't have like, you know, he didn't have like things that he could give us or like, you know, have memorabilia and things that he handed out to us. All he had was the skills he learned, how to, you know, how to break down a pig, how to, you know, break down a cow, how to butcher. And that's what, as you know, growing up, that's what I learned from him. And my mom, she taught us different kinds of recipes and sauces that she would make. And I kind of just picked up on that. And for me, it was just one of those things where I, you know, it made sense to me. And so, you know, we say within our restaurant group, we just say, hey, every dish has a narrative. If you follow that narrative long enough and close enough, you get to the people behind the food. And once you're there, it's actually not about food. It's about people.
Now, you are focusing on Hmong food at your restaurant. When I've encountered Hmong food, a lot of times it's a restaurant with Hmong food and Thai food and Vietnamese food or Chinese food, other things mixed in. Yeah. I think out of fear that somebody like me, and this is true, wasn't going to know what I was getting into with Hmong food. How do you distinguish if somebody says, yeah, I know a little bit about Thai food or Vietnamese food. How do you distinguish what they're going to encounter at your restaurant?
Yeah. So I always tell people that, you know, Southeast Asia, like we're all kind of weird cousins. You know, we all kind of like, you know, pick from the same, you know, the same kind of palate background. So yeah, you know, you're right about that, because some of the first Hmong entrepreneurs who are cooks here, you know, if you would say, hey, well, I'm opening a Hmong restaurant, people would be like, what are you talking about? You know? So then a lot of times they had to open under, like a Thai or a Chinese, you know, title, just so that, you know, that, white diners wouldn't feel too strange coming in. And so what we say is that the way that we do Hmong food, it reflects our story. So, for example, being up here in the Midwest, you know, a lot of the produce and product that we use reflects the land that it comes from. So, you know, we're based out of Minneapolis, but a lot of the, like, for example, we use a lot of root vegetables, you know, in the fall, in the winter, we're heavy on the root vegetables, just like any of these our, you know, Swiss and Norwegian brothers and sisters up here, you know, we're heavy, you know. Even a few years ago, we got into the hot dish game, you know, making a Minnesota Hmong hot dish. That's what we called it. And, you know, the way that we did, you know, I broke down what a hot dish is and why a hot dish was important, and just said, wow, like the story behind a hot dish resonates inside the story of every Hmong immigrant I know.
We're talking to Yia Vang, a chef and owner of a couple of restaurants, including Union Hmong Kitchen in Minneapolis, St. Paul. We're talking about Hmong cooking in this edition of Food Friday. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences eating Hmong food last week or growing up. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We've got a link up to some of your recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. I want to visit in with a couple of them now. I love the name of this one anyway, Purple Sticky Rice. Tell us the story behind this one.
Yeah, Purple Sticky Rice is a very, very common dish you'll find in every, you know, Hmong household. You know, a lot of times, when you're eating, especially from the old land, you know, like in Thailand and Laos, my mom would say that when we were in the refugee camp, sometimes we would be so poor that you wouldn't even like a whole your family group might have like three spoons. That's all you would have because you were so poor. And but what sticky rice does is sticky rice is the vessel you use to kind of pick up the food, right? To pick up the meat or whatever food you want to do and you want to pick up. That's what the sticky rice does. So basically sweet rice, which is a high gluten rice, which it doesn't mean it has gluten in it, but it has a lot of sugar in it. So it's a sweet rice. So it's different from jasmine rice or short grain rice. It's a sticky rice. So we soak it with black rice. There's a black rice, and it leaches that color off, and then it gives that purple color. We steam it. It's a little sweeter. And then I see people a lot. Sometimes people eat it with a fork, and sticky rice is being eaten with your hand. So you just put the rice in your hand, you move it around, and you almost like you create a little flatbread with, like a little circular, like 2-inch circular disc with it. And then you take the piece of meat or some peppers and you squeeze it right in the middle and you just pop it in your mouth. So it's all about creating a perfect bite with the sticky rice.
And if we can't find that that black rice that gives the distinctive color, can we still make the dish even though it's not going to look as cool?
Absolutely. It would just be, they'll just call it, people call it sticky rice, it's just, but the purple sticky rice thing, I will be really honest. Like all my friends, their kids love it. They're like, yeah, that's the only thing my kids eat because it's purple. And they're like, Dad, nice. It's purple. Look.
Now here's this is a great time of year to talk about this one. I fired up my grill for the first time this season, this week. Actually, let's talk about grilling. This is a big part of your cooking, isn't that right?
Absolutely. Yep.
And so you've got a recipe, a tri-tip steak with tiger bite sauce. Tell us about this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, we do this tri-tip steak. Tri-tip is not a very common, I guess, over in California, it's more common in the California area, SoCal area, but tri-tip is not a real common cut. But, we're one of our good friends, Eric, who owns Lowry Hill Meats. He's a butcher friend of ours. And he's one of those guys where I can just sit down and be like, hey man, like give me a different cut of meat that most people won't use. Cause everyone's like ribeye, filet, strip, whatever. So you get the tri-tip and then, we do this rub on it. It's a coffee rub. So we have a friend up here, Folly Coffee. We get their coffee and then we make this coffee rub with the Szechuan peppercorn. And then you rub that down and you put it over the fire and you slowly, with tri-tip, you kind of have to slowly watch it and keep turning it, And then the tiger bite sauce is basically, it's a cilantro based sauce, but it is one of the most basic hot sauce in a Hmong household. We in our house, we just call it hot sauce, or do you just call it quetzal, which literally means peppers or hot sauce. So we said, hey, I have a little marketing background. So I'm like, you know what? We have to make it sound sexier. We got to make it sound like people want to get it. So we call it tiger bite. So here's the real story behind it. So the word tiger bite in Hmong, if you say that word in Hmong, it's a very bad curse word. So what we did, but if you say it, but if you say it in English, it translates to tiger bite. And so we were like, it was kind of like a funny joke between us, a few of the cooks. And I, even till today, I cannot say that word out loud. Like I can't even say the actual word in my head because I feel my mom like washing my mouth with soap.
We'd have to bleep you on the radio. Yeah,
I know. So, but it translates out to tiger bite. And so we just said, hey, we'll call this tiger bite hot sauce. And all the Hmong kids who understand the joke, if you know it, kind of deal, they think it's hilarious. So, it's a kind of a little inside joke. If you speak Hmong, we also found out that it actually makes a really great name for hot sauce.
And it isn't just hot though. I mean, the combination of flavors in it it's got the cilantro, it's got the chilies, but also mm-hmm. garlic, shallots. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing a fish sauce and oyster. It's got a lot going on beside the heat, right?
Definitely. So Thai chilies, I think the thing is all chilies are made differently. Then the way the chilies are hot, or heat wise for the chili, it's all different. So Thai chilies. So the way that you have the sauce is when you dip that piece of steak in there and you get that sticky rice, you put it in your mouth. And as you eat it, what starts to happen is you get that herbaceous pop of the cilantro. And then you get that acid from the lime. And then you get that aromatics from the shallots and the garlic. And then you get that full umami savory flavor from the fish sauce. You get all those in the front, and in the back, slowly that Thai chili, that heat starts creeping in. But if that heat is in the front, like say if you eat a jalapeno, it's like just it'll hit you right in the face, right in the front. And what it does when your tongue is on fire, you can't taste any of that. So with Thai chili, you can taste all that flavor, and then that heat slowly comes from the back, and it kind of like it rounds out that whole flavor. So that's why. I feel like this sauce is such a great sauce that you could put on. Sauce is so great. One of the dishes that we do is grilled walleye, right? You pull out a walleye from the river, you grill the walleye over the grill, and then you take this sauce and you just pour it right over.
Sounds fantastic. We're talking to Chef Yia Vang right now about Hmong cuisine on this week's edition of Food Friday. He owns restaurants, including Union Hmong Kitchen in Minneapolis-St. Paul area. We can claim him here in the Dairy State. I believe he's from Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about Hmong cuisine? Are there recipes you've tried in the past that you want to share? Have you incorporated Hmong flavors into your cooking? Did you grow up eating the kind of foods we're talking about? Is there a special memory that you have or a dish you'd like to pass and share with us today? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue our Food Friday conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation about Hmong cuisine with Chef Yia Vang on this week's edition of Food Friday. You could join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Chef Vang, did I have that right? You're originally from here in Wisconsin.
I am a Wisconsin boy at heart. Grew up in central Wisconsin, a little town called Port Edwards. I ended up doing my undergrad at UW-La Crosse. I love my double cheese butter burger from Culver's. I love my cheese curds. I love my custard. You know, I always get asked, you know, like, hey, are you Hmong or are you American? I said, yes. So I'm a Wisconsin kid at heart. I love Wisconsin. I'm a Packer fan living in Minnesota.
Viking territory. So
we get some issues over here, but you know, it is what it is.
What led you into a world of being a professional chef?
So I tell people I never wanted to do this. I my whole life has been trying to get out of it. I always tell the thing, it's like growing up and you know, it's like that girl you date, but then, you know, you end up breaking up, but you end up back together. And it's, you know, after 15 years of it, you're like, you know, we've been around each other long enough. Might as well just put a ring on it. And so that was the relationship I had with the restaurant world, you know, back and forth. And, you know, eventually it was just a job for me. And then eventually there was this re-falling in love with it when I got a chance to really realize that food isn't just sustenance. It's a storytelling tool that we can use food to tell our stories and get to know other people's stories. And so that's really, you know, it changed the way I view food. And it, you know, that was probably about 8 years ago. And it just then became this pursuit. And while doing that, I, you know, just fell in love with my mom and dad's story and really realizing who they are and how much they've given up their life so that I can have life. And so, you know, the rest of what we're trying to do is dedicate everything to their legacy here.
And this has been a tough year. I think it's no secret for people running restaurants with the pandemic. How have you adapted to that?
Yeah, so it has been a tough year. And there were moments where, you know, I was just like, what am I doing? What are we trying to do here? You know, we've been just through just some pretty hard stuff. So, you know, but the one thing that I remember is I just think about what mom and dad went through as they escaped Laos. My dad fought in the war as they escaped Laos. They raised us in the refugee camp, moved us to this country. You know, I just think about the things that they've probably gone through and the moments that they wanted to give up. And that kind of actually really gives me strength. The way that we've been able to shift a couple things is, you know, I tell people that, you know, a year or so ago, if you were saying, hey, you guys are going to be doing like take home meal kits, you know, take and reheat kind of meal kit kits, if you're going to be doing just pure takeout, I would just be like, I don't think that would really fly. I don't think that people would be into that. But that is actually what is, you know, keeping us going is a lot of these take home meal kits that we're doing.
And did I understand this right? You've won some awards with recipes you've adapted from your folks.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting. Yeah. We, a few years back, there's this, the Hmong sausage recipe we use is the one my dad taught us growing up. And we won a sausage contest with that. And, you know, it was really funny. I went home and I told him, I said, hey, Dad, we use your recipe. We won this contest. And he kind of just laughed. He's like, oh, people like that stuff? And I'm like, yeah, Dad. Like, it was incredible. Like, the mayor of Minneapolis came out and gave me the award, you know? Like, and I was, you know, talking. I'm like, yeah, Dad, like, this is like, people like this. And they're like, that's cute. You know, they're like, that's fun. You know, and I'm just like, okay. And the people that we competed with, they're incredible, you know, operators and great sausage makers here. And, you know, it was so cool. It was really fun. It's fun to be able to, you know, say, hey, Dad, like, this is so awesome, you know?
We're talking to Ye Vang, chef, owner of Union Hmong Kitchen and Vinay in Minneapolis, St. Paul. He's with us on this week's edition of Food Friday, talking about Hmong cuisine. Wanted to throw another recipe out there. And again, we've got links to a page with a bunch of Ye's recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. This one, potluck chopped salad. Tell us about this.
Yeah, absolutely. So when the first wave of Hmong immigrants and refugees that came here in 1975, a lot of the sponsors were Methodist and Lutheran churches. They sponsored the first wave of refugees that came here. And so what that meant was a lot of them lived with some of these, you know, church members, and they would, you know, live like, you know, like either just they live with them, or sometimes they'll stay in the basement and whatever. And so some of them learned how to cook. So you had these like Norwegian, Swiss families that were teaching, you know, Hmong families just some of these dishes. And one of the dishes was literally, this is like one of the most common Hmong dishes ever, is you take a bag of like dole, you know, like a salad bag, you take that out, and then, you know, you take ranch and mayo and you make a little sauce out of that, you know, a dressing, and then it's croutons, bacon bits, you know, and it's like a bag salad, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the Hmong people, some of the early Hmong families would take that, and they would add in cilantro, hard boiled egg, and, you know, and we've had this, and in the Hmong language, we just called it salad. It was just salad, you know, and we would have this at every potluck. We would have this at every church event. And I hated it because it would get so soggy at the end, you know, because it just sits in this pile of ranch, you know, and I was just, I'm like, this is so gross. But my mom would be like, always eat your salad. And I'm like, oh, this is horrible. And so as we were talking about this dish, I'm like, you know what? We're going to redeem this dish. Like, how do we make this like potluck salad, and how do we make it fresh? So we make our own ranch, you know, dressing. We, you know, and we throw in a few different things, and, you know, we kind of zhuzh it up, and, you know, put little doodads on it, you know, so we can charge a little more. And so we had this, and we showed it to some friends who were Hmong friends, and they were just like, oh my gosh, like, I totally know this dish, you know. But it was just, you know, it's a little different, you know, a little bit, but overall, it still had that same theme of, you know, you had these, you know, first wave immigrants, you know, and refugees, and they're mixing with, you know, people that, you know, that are living here. And it's, so it's just a really cool story to know how this salad became part of our, you know, food world, our culinary repertoire. And
it sounds like the serving suggestion, though, is don't let it sit out on the buffet table for 2 hours.
Absolutely. And know how to dress your salad, people. Know how to dress your salad, right? You know, that's my biggest thing.
Well, yeah, as people get vaccinated, things over the next year hopefully start to get back to normal. What are you looking forward to most at your restaurant?
Yeah, so we're in the midst of, you know, doing construction, breaking down ground for our new restaurant called V9. It will be our first brick and mortar restaurant ourselves. V9 is the name of the refugee camp that I was born in. It was the name of the refugee camp my parents met in. V9 is actually a very important refugee camp for a lot of Hmong families. From 75 to 92, about 65,000 refugees came through V9, and V9 is in Thailand. And out of those 65,000, majority of them ended up, out of those 65,000, about 90% of them were Hmong people. And out of those 90%, majority of them ended up here in the Midwest, in Wisconsin, all through Wisconsin, all through Minnesota. So V9 itself is a very important name for us. So that's the name of our restaurant. We're, you know, excited as we're building it out. You know, we're working through some issues. You know, it's every day, there's always a different problem, but we're excited just to get it open, to get people inside, have people sit down, be able to serve them, be able, you know, to kind of show like, hey, this is, you know, this is, and probably say this is a Hmong restaurant. You know, we don't have to use any other different, cultures to you know, be under that. This is a Hmong restaurant. We're making Hmong food for everyone.
Chef Vang, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, appreciate it so much.
That was Ye Vang, chef and the owner of Union Hmong Kitchen in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Also the season 3 host of Relish on Twin Cities PBS, co-host of the White on Rice podcast. Talked to him earlier this year about Hmong cooking. Find some of the recipes we talked about at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, more Americans speak 2 languages these days, and there are a lot of benefits. That's according to the author of the new book who joins us on Monday, America's Bilingual Century. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.